Hello and welcome to The Ether. Today is Tuesday, March 1st, 2022. This episode of The Ether is brought to you by Orbital Command, a community validator on Terra dedicated to educating, expanding, and promoting the Lunatic community. Take advantage of their Terra Luna Intel report on Telegram, which brings you the hottest news and updates on all things Terra each and every day. Find it using the link in the show notes. You can also support their community efforts by considering them next time you're delegating or redelegating your Luna. Find out more at orbitalcommand.io. This episode of The Ether is also brought to you by WeFund. WeFund is a community crowdfunding cross-chain incubator on Terra, and it's the first launchpad that implements a milestone funding release system to protect investors. All money raised for projects is deposited in Anchor Protocol, and it's refundable, and all decisions are based on community voting power. WeFund is community-focused and designed to be a user-friendly experience for both project creators and investors. Be sure to follow them on Twitter and join the Telegram for more information. Links are in the show notes and check them out online at WeFund.app. TerraSpaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. Today on The Ether, The Ship Show, Episode 1, with Kanav and Doquan. Let's take a listen.
Thanks everyone for joining. We'll get going here in just a few minutes. Thanks everyone for joining. Just looks like we're waiting on Doe, and then we'll go ahead and get started. All right, I think we've got everyone here. I want to start off by thanking everyone for joining this evening. This is the first episode of The Ship Show, which is a new spaces series hosted by Jump. The goal behind this show is, you know, we want to feature various builders in the space and bring light to all the incredible infrastructure being built to support this next generation of crypto and Web3. So with that said, my name is Eden. I'm the community manager at Jump Crypto, and I'll be your host tonight, accompanied by my co-host Zion from Terraform Labs, who I'll go ahead and let introduce himself now.
Hey, everyone. This is, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, this is Zion from Terraform Labs. So I'm on the communications team here at TFL. I also help with ecosystem development and a little bit of business development as well. And happy to be here with a couple gigabrains here in the DeFi space and able to pick their brains and ask them a few questions.
Yeah, I think we're all pretty excited to be kicking off this Spaces series with Kanav and Doe, two of the biggest minds in the space. So pretty good start to the series, I'd say. But that being said, yeah, tonight we'll be doing a deep dive with them into the Terra ecosystem, which already has an incredibly strong community behind it, as we can see from the turnout of this show already. As far as format goes for this space, myself and Zion will be switching off asking questions of our speakers, and then we'll end with inviting a few additional guests up to ask a couple of final questions. When that time does come, we just kindly ask that you avoid shilling of any projects and instead use that time to ask thoughtful questions of our speakers. So with all that being said, we'll go ahead and get things started. Kanav and Doe, you know, you both play a huge role in this ecosystem, and we're grateful to have you here with us to share some of your knowledge and with this group tonight. So if you wouldn't mind just starting off with a brief intro, I think that'd be great. I think many of us here know you already, but for those that may not, perhaps a quick intro would be helpful, and then we can dive straight into questions. So Kanav, why don't you kick us off?
Thanks, Eden. Hey guys, I'm Kanav. I'm the president of the crypto division at Jump Trading, Jump Crypto. Very excited that we're, you know, kicking this spaces off. Jump's doing a whole bunch of things in this space. One of the most exciting things we're involved in is the Terra ecosystem. So excited to be on this one with Doe.
Awesome. And what do you, Doe?
Hi guys, I'm Doe. I'm the founder of Terra Money, which ships the most decentralized and useful type of money in the world, UST. I've known Kanav for years now. We first connected in, I think, 2019. And then Yeah, it's been a really long time, man. So we, I think at our first call, we started talking about, you know, the market module in Terra where UST mints and redemptions are allowed, and we were talking about curvatures and
UST used to exclusively, and Luna used to exclusively trade on CoinEx and trade $10,000 a day. So I think we've come, we've come a good way.
A long way. Awesome. Thank you both. Like I said earlier, you know, we're really excited to have you both here. So thank you for taking some time out of your evening to speak with everyone here. With that being said, I think we'll go ahead and dive into some questions. So the first question is more of an open one to both of you, and one in which I think everyone would love to know, and that is, how and when did you first enter or discover crypto? You know, we've got new people entering the space every day, so I think hearing from the true early adopters of blockchain technology would be inspiring to most. So, you know, take us back to that day, the moment that initially inspired you to pursue crypto, eventually leading you both to where you are today. We can start with Doe for that one.
You know, before starting Terra, I was running a Wi-Fi mesh startup. So the technology we were developing allowed user devices to connect to each other over Wi-Fi Direct and Bluetooth. And so basically like a distributed telecom network. And you can imagine that a lot of standard Google search queries, like, you know, distributed network and things like that, turns up things like Bitcoin and Ethereum. So I first got acclimated there. And then like randomly around the same timeline, like a friend of mine invited me to a Facebook chat group that has that had seven people and was, you know, mostly, you know, people from our age group at from college, talking about, you know, like new ICOs and, you know, Ethereum and different types of apps that you can build on top. So that's sort of like how I started to get red-pilled, and that group grew to like 250 people. It was a Discord server of, you know, builders and investors and things like that. And then that's where I started to spend a lot of my time, like going to meetups, reading white papers, participating in communities. I think in those early moments, I started to develop the first intuition of what eventually Terra would become.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. To hear about a Facebook group of seven people growing exponentially is interesting, you know, coming in the world of Web3. So thanks for sharing.
Can I share a bit about yours?
Yep. So, yeah, I ran into crypto at Jump. And so I went to school at the University of Illinois, where Jump had a research lab where we were working on all kinds of random stuff. And so there was a VR project to abstract away trading screens. There was like a Bitcoin mining rig in the closet, and a bunch of interns were working on a trading project to connect to like OKEx and Poloniex and all the early crypto exchanges. And it was an awesome and really infectious environment. And as you know, we used to spin chairs and talk about crypto all day, and it was impossible to not get that filled. And so I came back to Jump, and I've been in crypto since.
That's awesome.
Do you mind if I interject with a question for Kunal?
Yeah, go ahead.
Right now, you and Jump, you guys do a lot of different things. So what are the things in DeFi that are the most interesting to you?
The things that brought us to DeFi to start, and for folks, and I probably skipped this in my introduction, but Jump is traditionally a prop trading firm. It's about 20 years old. It's the largest trader of futures in the world, and trades kind of a lot of other things as well, quantitatively. And when we started working with Doe and other founders in the space early on, it was primarily thinking through liquidity-related problems, you know, especially as it comes to Luna and UST. You know, Doe mentioned we were talking through the curvature of the market module, and then also, you know, the impacts of Luna liquidity on the robustness of PEG and things of that sort. And when we entered DeFi and we started encountering these problems, you know, it was programming in, you know, resource-constrained environments. It was complex systems, but that all existed in this completely trustless and highly composable fashion. And so it was the skills from, you know, high frequency trading and quant stuff generally translated over pretty nicely. And the whole composability aspect was huge, primarily because of just the absolute stagnation of the pace of development in traditional finance, right? So nothing's really changed in a really long time. There are kind of the same players moving at the same space with pretty tightly held nooses on new developments. And that's primarily because it's really, really hard to establish trust. So if you think about like how a future state is settled on the CME, for example, there's a matching engine and a swap occurs, but then behind the settlement of all that of that swap, there's a clearinghouse, there's an FCM, a DCM, there's like nine other like three-letter acronym intermediaries that go through from match to settlement of the funds, which causes, you know, lots of problems, lots of regulations, and it's all needed because otherwise you really don't know if your trade is, you know, going to reliably settle at the end of the day. And with crypto, the match is the settle, and that's dramatically powerful. And, you know, that then allows composition on top of these settlements, on composition on top of other products that are created as a result of these settlements. And that's caused such a dramatic, like, just change in the pace of innovation in financial markets. You know, I've talked about this before, but we've seen market structure on like the ETH blockchain alone evolve from being like the equivalent of open outcry to FIFO matching to continuous batch auctions with the introduction of flashbots. And just the existence of that pace of change is what's the single most exciting thing about this space, because you just don't want to bet against that, and you know that there's going to be a lot of cool stuff created. So that was a bit of a longer answer, but.
Got it. So it's sort of a follow-up. A lot of people think about what a lot of people that are like, especially active in DeFi, think about market makers and professional trading firms as predatory sharks, right? So there's this reputation that when like the yields for a DeFi product compresses, it's kind of like, oh, Knopf took my yields again, or like, who's the Alameda guy? Sam Trabuco or something like that? Yeah. Damn it, Sam. Yeah, kind of those memes are just like rampant everywhere. How do you feel that like the role of a professional trading firm like Jump Crypto in crypto? Like, how can you add value to this space? So what is it that you actually do? Like, are allegations of, you know, trading firms or predatory sharks, is any of that accurate?
So there's a few things that we do in this space, right? One is participation on centralized venues. And our role on the centralized venues is to keep pricing tied together, to beef up liquidity, to make sure that markets are in line and compressed, right? So like back in the day, if you remember like 2018 or so, like Coinbase listings would go off and the price on Coinbase would be like 15% higher than they would be on every other venue in the world. And, you know, the new retail kind of trader would come in and trade $100 in size and get really bad fill because there was bad liquidity on the product and suffer from really bad outcomes. So on the centralized side, what market makers are generally doing is reflecting and providing liquidity across all these venues so that there is a really, really tight spread for everyone to come in and participate. And the way that market makers make money is by effectively being on both sides of that spread. The hope is that, you know, there are some people that want to buy and some people that want to sell over a period of time. And if you're able to basically go through that loop a few times over a long period of time, that you'd be able to be paid for providing that service. So that's what Jump does on the centralized side. On the decentralized side, when you come to like the highly resource constrained environments like AMMs and stuff, there isn't really a lot of edge to be participating as a liquidity provider on an XYK. Like anybody with money can come in and deposit their capital on the pool. And the development of trading intelligence has little applicability there. Where we have been really involved on the DeFi side is in helping building infrastructure, right? So the couple of big projects that we've been very involved with are Pith and Wormhole. You know, Pith is Oracle project that leverages the trading data of big firms like Jump, Jane Street, Susquehanna, Alameda, and many others to create a robust Oracle price or wormhole, you know, which is a decentralized bridge between a number of dominant blockchains. And in finding those opportunities, as we've been involved in the space, we've been able to leverage our engineering talents that we use to build trading infrastructure to really hopefully add some value to the space and create some good stuff. I'd say the third bucket of what, you know, we've been really involved in is, of course, in governance and helping protocols build. So, you know, we put in the two of the early governance proposals that helped scale the USD float, you know, back when USD was at 10 million supply last December, when the market module had limited liquidity relative to the liquidity that was reflected on the centralized venues. And in helping protocols that are working through complex trading problems implement their strategies to achieve kind of maximum success while being aligned with them in the best way possible, right? So that was the smattering of things. We are 140 people on the Jump Crypto team now, and so we're trying to get involved in a lot of different ways.
Got it. So the two products that you're working on now, and moderators, like, feel free to cut me off whenever this gets boring, but just gonna run with it for now.
We do have a series of questions. So yeah, I mean, whenever we can get back on script, or we can let you guys have a quick chat.
Okay, I might interject later, but let's go back to the script.
Awesome.
Cool. So I had a question. So I'd like to get your guys' thoughts on this year of 2022. So looking at the current state of crypto, you know, what are your guys' expectations for 2022? Do you expect that, you know, we'll see user growth stall in the short term? You know, what are your thoughts or expectations there in 2022? This time we can start with Doe.
Yeah, so I think the big difference this year from 2017 was, in 2017, people were just creating random assets, right? So people are just, like, you know, creating ERC-20s or, you know, forks of Geth, and then marketing it to the public as, you know, sort of quote unquote the infrastructure of the future. And for most of them, people got wiped out. This time, the bubble is starting to form, but it's more on the NFT side. So I literally laughed for 5 minutes straight, not skipping a second in between when I looked at the Pixelmon output. That was so super hilarious. I'm almost thinking that I'm attributing this to entertainment value rather than malice. I think they intentionally tried to be funny, because, like, the output there for a $70 million mint was absolutely hilarious. So, and, like, this is pretty obvious, right? So at any given situation, like, if there isn't a clear leader in sort of, like, the assets that have been formed in the NFT space, like, the first intuition is, why not me? Why can't I mint that asset that's going to be, you know, like, the next, you know, the CryptoPunks and, or the Bored Apes, or things like that? And I think some of these efforts are laudable. But right now we have an oversupply of games like minting their own NFTs, or, you know, artists that are creating new NFT collections. Once again, a lot of these things are valuable, but there's an oversupply, and the marginal effort of these things are going down, especially with a lot of tools and help from the existing NFT community starting to build up. I think in 2022, the transition that we need to see is fewer people wanting to mint assets, but wanting to work with existing assets to build a community around it, and in some cases to build marginal businesses. Similar to how lots of things in DeFi, yes, usually there is a governance token of some sort to, you know, to support liquidity, or to, you know, vote on important parameters in the protocol. But by and large, how DeFi works is that it works with the base of an ever consolidating set of existing assets and protocols, right? So in that case, new protocol builders that are coming into the ecosystem augment the stuff that has already been built. It doesn't exist. It doesn't try to do the same thing over and over again. So there's less horizontal expansion. There's more vertical building. I think the new attempts that are coming in, you know, sort of quote unquote the metaverse space, it's interesting. But right now, everybody is doing the exact same thing: the same play to earn game, the same NFT, and it's an ever expanding
list a horizontal expansion of new assets that are entering the system. I think that should transition to vertical building, where, for example, people can collect five different NFTs and then write a fantasy lore behind it, where there could be a new Netflix series, or there could be like a game where people are allowed to import their identities from their NFT collections. So I think a lot of these things are going to be value additive to the entire space. And I think it's going to weed out people that are looking to make a quick buck or scam.
Can I
also jump in with a quick question here?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, definitely.
So do you know, of course, a large part of your team is still in Korea and you've spent a good amount of time there. Korea is always, known to be a very technologically forward country, and there's like established metaverse type projects there. Without the NFTs, like, what are the kinds of NFT projects that you think are going to be really exciting, especially when you think about some of the existing stuff that you see in that ecosystem, in the Korean ecosystem?
Yeah, so that's really interesting. So, I think for a lot of the new games and metaverse attempts that are coming out from Korea, I think I've been fortunate in the sense that I've been able to influence or give advice to a lot of these projects that manifest as they come out. And the first intuition is always to do, let's do what Axie did, or let's mint our own NFT collection by using this K-pop label or something like that. But I think ultimately the most exciting thing about crypto, be it fungible tokens or non-fungible tokens, is that it creates the conception of property rights on the internet. And what I mean by this is that before we had the meat space and the digital world, and it was only possible to work and play in one of them, the physical world. Because in the digital world, there were no property rights to speak of. So it wasn't possible to build your own domain. It wasn't possible to build your own property. A billionaire and a middle school student would have the same property rights, the same LinkedIn page, the same email address. And the only distinction and the only types of businesses that you could really build on top of this were online advertising, Web2. Like, you can use our shit for free, but we will sell your data. Web3, I think, is exciting because it allows you to construct property rights on the internet. And in order to do this, for property rights to be valuable, you need people that respect them. So what I mean is there's a nascent sort of conception of property rights that are starting to form over NFTs and fungible tokens. So I think the role of a lot of these new metaverse plays or games as they're coming out is that I think it's okay for them to mint some of their assets, but as long as they respect the property rights of the systems that came before. So for example, in Korea, every single public gaming company, AAA publisher, is going to be in Web3 in 2022. A lot of those plays are going to be built on Terra. And what I try to stress is, try to inject this mental model of NFTs and fungible tokens as being frameworks for property rights. And the way that you can win over and captivate communities is to make sure that their existing property rights are respected. So for example, there is a pretty interesting play where it's kind of like a open digital space where people can import their NFTs from multiple different chains. So these 2D NFTs become 3D avatars, and then people can chat with each other, they can shop for new things. So there's like brand alliances. So it's basically like a shopping mall type of experience, like Saks Fifth Avenue. And then you can each visit like some of these stores and buy, in some cases, new NFTs, or like play mini games like in this metaverse. But at the end of the day, like the base layer assumption is that this would be a place where you can bring utility to the property that you already own.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, man. I think the first time that clicked was when there was a team at ETH Denver a couple of years ago that built a trading card game that let you inherit properties from your CryptoKitties. And hopefully all the cool stuff that's coming out of the AAA titles in Korea will be much, much more heavily featured and a lot more involved. So it'll be cool to see a bunch of that. On the DeFi side, you were talking about a bunch of the vertical integration. What are some of the primitives that you're most excited about
that are being built on Terra or otherwise that are vertically integrating on top of a lot of the cool pieces we have today?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, I can't name these things by name because I think a lot of them are stealth, and I think I should preserve the ability to control their own destiny in terms of announcements and things like that. But like one of the things that I'm really interested in is this idea that stories are basically the base layer for culture. If you look at a lot of these like NFTs, it's as if like you've sort of inverted the traditional IP publishing process, where usually if you have a IP franchise like the Marvel series or Harry Potter, you build the story first, which encapsulates the reader. And then you have either figurines or different types of IP that result from that, that can be purchased and bring revenue to the original creator. In the world of NFTs, it's the opposite, whereby you have NFT collections that have value, but prior to a story being constructed. So this new protocol, I think, is like pretty interesting because it allows communities to come together and then decide on a canonical version of fan fiction that is going to be the defining story for IP. And this ownership of this IP doesn't belong to one person, but it's distributed over the community that helped to make that story its own. So some of the use cases that you can use something like this is that, for example, you could take NFT collections and then constitute and weave together a story on top of this NFT collection that makes the collection more valuable. And then once you have this story, you have a baseline, you have the base layer and building blocks by which you can spin this out into, let's say, games, or you can spin this out into movies, you can spin this out into serial fiction. And once you do this, another benefit of this is that it's not monolithic, right? So it's not one author deciding on a canonical version of what the story should be. And the cultural relevance of this story, with the exception of a few titles, ends at some point. But it's constantly evolving, as in there's fan fiction that's being layered in, new boundaries that are being explored, new stories that are being tacked on to the existing version. So it's a living and breathing document that forms a base layer for different types of cultural things to be built on top.
Do I get in, man?
Oh, get in?
How do I get in?
Only Angel, no jump dollars.
No jump dollars. All right, I'll take it.
Yeah. Eden, do you have a question?
I do. Thanks for asking. The next question is for Kanav. With countless dApps being continuously built within the ecosystem, I'm curious to know, what do you like to see developers working on as they enter the space? Like, how do they build a great product such as the Terra protocol?
Yeah, I think for people that are like really, really fresh into Web3, it's hard to get an exact grasp on what the problem set is that people are really grasping with. And so, like Doe said, there's a big temptation to fork the next P2E or fork the next yield farm and try to spin something up. An effort that I've seen a lot of people in the space make, and Doe especially over the last couple of days has also had a few threads out on, are, there's a lot of problems in the space that folks like us, folks like Doe, really want to see built, but don't have the bandwidth and capacity to get to. And there's a lot of high quality capital available to help shape and build it. And so for real builders and for real founders, there are, I think, increasingly now better and better outlets to find, good meaty problems to attack that can be attacked in actually a broad number of capacities, even in like completely spinning out new business lines, running their own businesses off of various verticals that are unestablished, or even just doing, a pretty concrete chunk of work for major projects. And so, for example, with Wormhole, which is an interoperability protocol that we've been helping build, it's pretty hard to have like cross-chain UX where you need to have gas assets on both sides. So if you want to move from Solana to Terra or the other way, you need to have both Sol and Luna. But if you can have intermediate relayers that are willing to take a fee to basically abstract that problem away from you, that dramatically improves the UX for a lot of people. And similar to that, there are a lot of other components that just need to be built in this space. And there's good spaces where those have been documented now. Bill probably has some good additions to this as well.
Yeah. So for a long time, TFL defined itself as an app factory, right? So the idea was that we sort of thought about ParaUSD as the most important product at the firm. And then we would spend lots of time building features to make this money the most useful form of currency there is. But like one of the things that we realized is as we kept doing this, we ran into two problems. So we sort of like became overstretched because we were running too many different things at the same time. So it's not like you can just like ship out a protocol and just like leave it, right? So in some cases, it picks up enough organic community and builders such that they can sort of run with the protocol on its own. And it's happened in a couple of cases. But in some cases, the first version that we ship happens to be off from what we expected because of a few reasons, in which case we need to work on, you know, V2s. We need to work on getting more builders involved to make sure that the protocol can stand strong on its own. So after some point, like we became overstretched as an organization. So we couldn't do too many different things at the same time. So what we tried thereafter is sort of an EIR program where people would just come to us and then we would give them an idea. We would help them hire developers and builders. And sort of like the result of these programs were things like Pylon protocol and Valkyrie, which are both products of the EIR program at Terra. Now, and the goal is that we would eventually spin these companies out, which we did for both of them. I think this method can work well. It's just that it's hard to parallelize this across multiple different things. And the longer that I stay in crypto, we start to build up like a repository of a ton of different ideas that we think would be valuable in Web3. But the issue is that the incentives in crypto are broken, right? Because you could just like come in as an anon, and then you could fork like four different protocols, slap on a token, raise money from crypto VCs, and then walk away with, you know, whatever figures that you could get away with in that case. So if you compare that with the effort, so you could get like an NFT mint, like Pixamon, and make $70 million. You could do this in, you know, a few weeks. Or you can launch like a meme coin like Shiba Inu, and that was probably billions of dollars in returns for the creators. And if you compare that with like the slow grind of having to think through like a valuable infrastructure for Web3 to tackle the hard problems, to put in, you know, 100 hours a week, month over month for several years, the incentives are misaligned, which I feel like why a lot of the entrepreneurial efforts are spent on replicating the same thing over and over again with a small marketing pitch. But I think one of the most exciting things that I've started to observe is that there are people that break these incentives. They want to buck the trend. They don't care about short-term incentives because they're the most interested in leaving their mark on the world, right? And then if you look them in the eye, there's like little glint where like you know that what they want to do is to someday to bend the entire earth to their will, which sounds incredibly evil, but it speaks of ambition and the things that they're willing to do in order to make Web3 better. So essentially, I think the proposal is simple. Like if you want to get into Web3, you have an interesting idea, or you can, it doesn't matter if you don't have an idea, then in that case, like just come to, you know, me or Kanav. We're starting to put together accelerators across the world where you can get, you know, lots of time with us in trying to think through the types of things that you want to build. Help in development resources or mechanism designs in getting your protocol to product market fit. And like everything starts with a DM. So let's do that.
That's a good one.
Very true. Awesome. Thank you so much, Doe, for that. So let's dive into a little bit more about Terra and UST specifically. Attractive features of Terra are its security and stability. I'd love to ask Doe to explain more about how UST achieves stability, and then we'll ask Kanav to tell us a little bit more about the Luna Foundation Guard and what that means for security.
Got it. So the easy way of explaining how UST maintains PEG is that Luna absorbs the volatility of Terra stablecoins. So at any given point, you can swap, you can mint one pair USD by burning $1 worth of Luna, and then you can always redeem one pair USD for $1 worth of Luna as well. So during times in which the market demand for USD falls, there's an arbitrage incentive. So for example, if Luna starts to trade at 90 cents, then traders can make money by buying USD from the open market, swapping it to Luna, and then capturing a 10% arb profit. On the other side, if USD is trading at $1.1, you can buy $1 worth of Luna from the open market, swap it to USD, and then capture 10% arb profit that way. So insofar as you have a liquid market for Luna at some market value, UST is able to facilitate minting redemptions in a highly scalable, purely algorithmic kind of way.
So, the place that like the LFG comes in to augment is, you know, Do talked about how you can potentially, you know, create or redeem UST by interacting with Luna markets, and like you said, the Luna liquidity is kind of paramount to making that stable and robustly possible at reasonable size in periods where the USD economy is significantly contracting or expanding. And you know, as we said at the start of the show, I think we've come a giant amount of ways in Luna liquidity throughout the broader ecosystem relative to, you know, even a year ago when it was trading, I think, you know, probably less than $100 million or so daily. And so that in itself adds a lot of margin in there being, you know, a thick and deep enough book that can absorb these moves. But on extraneous circumstances in tail situations, you know, which of course do happen, sometimes there are contracted short periods where the outflows, for example, can, you know, be of a larger quantity than the liquidity in the book at that point in time can facilitate. And so, you know, this is like kind of like a classic like liquidity crisis. And for periods of those natures, you know, it's extremely useful to have a reserve that can step in until the market is able to kind of reconsolidate liquidity around those positions again. And so the LFG, you know, holds $1 billion of Bitcoin, which is an extremely sizable treasury reserve. And the LFG also has plans to increase its reserve size. And it's basically meant to take out these extreme spikes and inject liquidity into the book and allow markets to consolidate again around the new prices when there are, you know, extreme price movements, which do happen every sometime. And look, correct me if there's something I've missed there or if I haven't characterized that exactly just right.
No, I think that's perfect. And I think the expectation is that LFG and Michael Saylor are going to compete on, well, whatever it is that Saylor does.
I'm betting on the LFG horse here.
Yeah, so you can expect the reserves from LFG to scale with the growth of UST as it gets more widely adopted. And I think we should be, we're sort of finalizing and tinkering with the mechanism design as we speak, but I think we should be able to go public with something more soon. And you can sort of think about like these reserves that are being held in Bitcoin to be like a decentralized Forex augmentation to the Terra protocol. It'll live in a purely algorithmic, decentralized way on a smart contract.
The pre-alpha drop by Doe here. Yeah, we'll have an announcement hopefully coming out soon with the mechanism design there for LFG. But one thing I wanted to talk about with you, Doe, and then also maybe get Kanav's thoughts as well, was around UST, you know, used as money. So, Doe, if you could, you know, we talked a little bit about it already, you know, what separates UST from some of these other stable coins like DAI and USDT and things like that. But, you know, this is really, you know, the stable coins like UST on Terra are kind of the core innovation of the Terra protocol and one of the things that separates it from some of these other L1. So could you tell us a little bit more about UST and maybe the road ahead with where you see UST going?
So the way that I think about it is when we first started the Terra experiment, I think in 2017 and 2018, and like the central thesis was that a decentralized economy needs decentralized money. A lot of people didn't really buy into that premise because the world wasn't as as much on fire back then. But today, literally, there's so much censorship going on in centralized money that even nation states are looking to decentralize monies in order to disintermediate or to remove themselves from either sanctions or different types of censorship. So we live in a simulation, essentially, where the need for decentralized money has never been greater. So I sort of think about Terra as a valuable hedge, as the flames of empire start to go out, and as the world slips into more and more chaos, I think the need for decentralized money is going to grow and grow. And I think that growth is being reflected and is playing out exactly as we speak. One of the things that people don't realize is that USD would be growing faster if it wasn't for the liquidity constraints that are placed on the market module. So actually, USD is expanding its monetary base at the fastest rate of throughput that it can right now, which is indicative of the massive amounts of latent demand that is sitting in the background. Now, I think we largely look to three areas of growth for USD. I think number one is the growth of USD on the Terra blockchain. Terra as a layer one happened almost by accident, as we set up a smart contract layer from the Cosmos and Quantio team to experiment with building protocols and use cases for USD like Mirror and Anchor. But now it is currently one of the most vibrant L1 ecosystems out there. And it is the second largest smart contract platform by TVL after Ethereum, and the third largest by market cap after Ethereum and BNB. So I think that growth is going to continue. There's a lot of amazing innovations that are coming to the Terra blockchain. And as across gaming, DeFi, story creation, culture. So I think all of these projects are going to start to add significantly to USD market cap, and as well as augmenting the strength of the protocols that came before. Second is cross-chain, and Wormhole plays a valuable role in this. Our goal is to make sure that UST is the most liquid and the most successful stablecoin across all the smart contract platforms where there are developers and users. So, and with Wormhole, we're building a UST highway to deliver Terra stablecoins to every blockchain. Right, so we will be big in Solana, we'll be big in Avalanche, we'll be big in Polygon. And we expect that not only liquidity will start to form on these blockchains, but we will be active in building applications on these blockchains, as well as helping other developers that are building DeFi protocols with a strong need for decentralized money and building other types of cross-chain applications as well.
Yeah, that's super exciting. I can't wait to see UST continue to expand and see some of these interesting new applications on these other chains. Eden, do you want to another question here?
Yeah, I'm actually, just following up on that, I'm actually interested, and this is a question for Doe. Can you speak a little bit more to the potential of the in real life applications of Terra as far as online and offline payments and dApps overall? And usability there. I'm just curious what you think is possible in the coming days and weeks.
A couple of years ago, I used to discuss this as a future. It's no longer the case. So I would say every fintech company, every payment processor is looking to integrate crypto over the next 2 years. They just haven't pulled the trigger yet, because if you work in a massive fintech company, like your ship cycle looks, you basically ship once a year, right? But if you account for that lag, basically, there are no, let's say, neobanks that are not looking to tap into DeFi yields for their users, because to not do so today is going to look like commercial suicide. Because if you're a neobank and then you're offering 0.5% on what you call quote unquote high yield savings, and your competitor comes along and offers you, let's say, 10% or 15%, you are literally screwed. You will be out of business in 6 months. And if you're a payment processor, and if the spreads that you're charging are significantly higher than what your competition is able to do because they do it through Terra FX rails, then you will be out of business in 2 years tops, right? So essentially, as crypto becomes more liquid and decentralized stablecoins are able to perform at the liquidity and the throughput of the commercial systems that power the financial internet of the world, I think decentralized stablecoins will be a mainstay across every single main commercial application.
Awesome. Thank you so much for diving into that. Appreciate it. You've also said before that you feel we are earlier in the beginning. Do you still feel this way? And if so, how long do you think you'll feel like this?
I think it's possible that it's always the beginning until I die. But I think so. Like, my mental model is if my backlog shrinks, i.e. the types of problems that we are looking to solve, if that diminishes in size or diminishes in ambition, then I would say that we are entering into like a stable or stable growth state. But that has never happened. Actually, like, the more fires that we put out, the more things that we ship, I see even more opportunities and the types of problems that we need to solve. So I would say we're always at the beginning. Things are so early.
Kanav, I'd be interested. Sorry, Eden, I just wanted to turn that over to Kanav as well and just get his thoughts and, you know, in terms of where he thinks we are in kind of crypto and DeFi's life cycle.
Yeah, I mean, strongly concur, though. As you start building more, you always just discover the infinite space of things that need to be built. And, you know, then you're always hoping for just this one thing to get built. And then that one thing uncovers the next end. And so that's kind of the perpetual state of building. The reality is we're super, super early, right? There's like one or two wallets total that even have reasonable UX for any kind of activity. Anyone that even wants to buy an NFT, which is the most retail-friendly activity possible, has to navigate through all the craziness of MetaMask and put offers and bids out. And it's basically impossible to use. And as we see consumer behaviors evolve and front ends keep on integrating all the complex fun games that we've been building in the background, I think, you know, we're hopefully going to start at least reaching the first 100 million real users of crypto. So pretty early.
I couldn't agree more.
Good to hear that we're early. I think everyone likes to hear those words. Awesome. Great. Well, I did want to make a quick mention that we do have an active POAP for this event. So if you're familiar with that, everyone in the audience, you can download the app from poap.xyz and then enter the phrase Doe and Kanav ship !! It's going to be all one word, each word capitalized. And you'll get an exclusive collectible token for proof of attendance at this event. So just wanted to make sure that we mentioned that on the call tonight. And I think we can segue into some questions from the audience. I think we have someone, Satoshi Alien, looking to come up and ask a question. I'm going to invite you up as a speaker now.
Hey, guys. How's it going? When it comes to like the LFG, obviously, like, Bitcoin is a big asset for it. Are there any other plans to expand the reserves at all at some point?
We're both directors here, so I think we can both answer, but yes.
Yeah, I think scaling with the float as it comes out will be quite important, so that the liquidity reserve is commensurate with the adoption of USD and the liquidity that's needed to absorb kind of, you know, some of those 10%-ish moves in the expansion or contraction of the economy. And so working through, you know, Wado and the rest of the LFG team on potential ways to, you know, execute that most effectively, and then potentially diversify. And so I think there'll be some cool stuff coming out pretty soon.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Cool. So we got Tundra coming up here as well. Tundra, you have a question?
Yeah. Hey, guys. And hey, Doe and Kanav, thanks for putting this on. Doe, you mentioned that the growth rate of UST is currently happening basically as fast as it can due to some liquidity point that I think you made. Can you maybe expand on that just a little bit?
Sure. So what I mean by that is, the mechanism to swap UST and Luna is actually a virtual AMM, which means that when you're swapping in Luna to mint UST, you're essentially creating at some virtual conception that the protocol has for the pool of UST that trades against a pool of Luna that has just been burned, right? So the idea is that like the Luna that's just been burned doesn't explicitly sit in an AMM pool, but the protocol has some sort of conception on what are the sizes of the Luna to UST pool that should observe the XYK invariant. So after some point, if there's too much minting demand, the slippage cost that you need to pay in order to mint starts to go up, similar to the types of fees that you need to pay on Astroport, right? So if we're burning, let's say, $1 to $2 million, $1 to $2 million Luna per day, beyond that, like the slippage cost that the user would need to pay in order to mint UST would be higher than whatever slippage cost that they would need to pay in the open market. So that's what I mean by maximum throughput. Similar to what happened in May of 2021, where there were too many UST redemptions that were looking to happen against Luna, in which case the AMM slippage cost rose the other way. And it took a few days for the protocol to be for the slippage cost to naturally heal back to spot. So that's another feature of the market module, where when the exchange rate has deviated from the peg, the protocol automatically brings self-heals the exchange rate back to whatever the spot price is being quoted by the Oracle. So that's why it took several days for the peg to recover.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that makes sense. And I've noticed that over the past 17 days, we've had like $100 million in UST growth pretty consistently, actually 18 days as of today. I'm curious, like, do you see that as an issue, or how are you kind of thinking about that in terms of like widening the bandwidth in terms of getting more UST created?
Yeah, actually the sizing of the pools isn't something that we discretionarily set, right? It's bounded by existing Luna and UST liquidity. Right now, that liquidity has gone up a lot. We recently readjusted the liquidity parameters so that we can mint a lot more in a given day. But I think it's just one of those things that we modify through governance proposals over time.
Got it. Thank you, Doe.
Thank you so much. We're going to bring up some more people to talk. Let's get K.Ching. You can now speak whenever you're ready. The floor is yours.
Hi. Thanks, Doe and Kanav. Quick question on regulation. I understand that, you know, stablecoin, that's going to be heavily regulated, especially with USDC and USDT. Just curious on how UST will look in terms of regulation, especially if there's massive adoption across major applications. And thank you guys, love your work.
Got it. So there are lots of reasons why governments would want to regulate centralized stablecoins. So I think the quick answer is, I don't think algorithmic stablecoins or decentralized currencies are in scope of regulatory interest just quite yet, because I think regulators are more interested in things like, you know, the potential where fraud could happen, where, like, let's say stablecoin issuers of USDC, Tether, Paxos are not keeping the money in safe deposits like they're representing to the public. But ultimately, like, the areas of interest for regulators can evolve, like the areas of interest for the private sector. And I think the goal there is to get to a state where UST is being widely used, its utility as to why, you know, the state and money should be separated. If that becomes, you know, a matter of common opinion and things like that, then in that case, so this will be, you know, one of those things that is impossible to shut down, similar to Bitcoin itself.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your question. We are just 5 minutes out from the hour. So I think we'll go ahead and start wrapping up the spaces. I did want to give kind of in Doe, you know, the last chance to share any final thoughts before we close out. So the floor is yours, gentlemen. If any last words.
You want to go first, Carl?
Well, I just wanted to, you know, I just started off saying, you know, that the first time we spoke was in 2019, and I hadn't really quite internalized that until now. And so, yeah, it's been really, really awesome, you know, working with you and the rest of the Terra community for over 2 years now. kind of quite stunning to think about how far things have come. So yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, it's been awesome. So
yeah, it's the pleasure has all been mine. And it's kind of crazy how like our relationship has evolved to, you know, like sort of synergistic with like decentralized money and the base layer for cross-chain infrastructure and things like that. And we're sort of collaborating as builders to, you know, from my perspective, to take Terra assets across multiple chains and for Wormhole to, you know, connect all the blockchains together.
That's right. That's right. Who would have thunk it? All right.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for joining tonight. And a huge thank you again to Kanav and Doe for speaking and sharing the knowledge you have this evening. Please be sure to follow both of our speakers on Twitter, as well as Terra.money and Jump Crypto for all content and everything DeFi. Good night, everyone. Thanks again.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for checking out another episode of The Ether. That was The Ship Show, Episode 1, with Kanav and Doquan, recorded on Tuesday, March 1st, 2022. This episode of The Ether was brought to you by Talus. Talus Protocol is the NFT platform for independent artists on Terra. Talus helps to provide artists with the tools and resources needed to transition from traditional art into the NFT world. With their V1 launch coming soon, Talus will be the place to see real-world art reflected on Terra. Be sure to join their Telegram and follow Talus on Twitter for updates on their roadmap, validator, and other Talus news. Find your next favorite artist on talus.art. This episode of The Ether was also brought to you by LuArt. LuArt is the first gamified NFT platform built on the Terra network. LuArt provides a seamless minting and trading experience, all while earning you rewards just for being a user. Be sure to follow them on Twitter and join the community in the Discord server for the most up-to-date news and announcements regarding all the hot new NFT launches, platform upgrades, and new projects hitting the secondary marketplace. Are you ready to put your helmet on and join the movement? Find out more at luart.io. Terra Spaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. For TerraSpaces.org, I'm Finn. Thanks for listening. They say rapping is the gateway, bringing home great pay. Checking that replay, sing along and we say nobody gives a fuck around my way. I make about $3 for every 1,000 plays, so add it up and do the math on that. Financially speaking, why the fuck would anybody wanna rap? But in this reality, the money comes from doing shows. But then where's the money go when you can't do the shows? I guess you could rap on Cameo. I've been asking all my friends if I can rap on the patio. 6 feet, motherfucker, step the fuck back. Doing a little magic, pulling rabbits out the rucksack. Not everybody's always in it for the money. Looking like another crooked Sunday and I'm working Monday. So you know I ain't stressing, left debating great methods. Amazed to play Inception, the bass stay blessed.
See, even with these huge sums of overall royalties, the sums of money that go to the record label per playback can seem insultingly small. Many rights holders are making around three quarters of a cent to listen to one of their tracks, leaving only some portion of that for the actual artist.
Pennies per play.
Until they can figure out how to turn a profit, their future will always be in question. But for now, investors see enough potential to continue to fund pennies per play.
Another day, another lesson. Living in the eighth dimension might be worth a little mention. Living in the Great Depression, got a real regal feel. Reeling in another sucker fish out to make a deal, just to make a motherfucker wish. Aw shit, now you only got two left. You know what I wish? We didn't have any loose ends. You know what I miss? Listening to excuses. Now we're on the fence like we forgot how to choose. That's what happens when people don't know what's true. In the dark, eating bullshit up like a mushroom. In the lunchroom, just trying to laugh it off. Meanwhile, foaming at the mouth like a rabid dog. Like a fake mating call at the zoo. It's looking like the view is getting disappointing too. I'm working on the new shit, trying to produce it. It's what I'm willing to go through when I'm making my music.
Spaces.